You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of May 2012 here on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we look ahead to this year's Asian edition of the World Economic Forum with Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times. And we'll also be hearing why Kalashnikov, the makers of the AK-47, are gunning for a high-end range of clothing. And as former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair spends a day at the Leveson Inquiry, we get the latest from the investigation examining the links between the press and politicians. All that, plus we talk to a US flag maker on Memorial Day, and we'll be playing some good tunes as well. All that to come in the next hour, right here on Midori House. And good evening from Studio One here in London. Much more to come over the next 59 minutes, but first the headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan has arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus as violence continues 6 weeks after he struck a ceasefire deal. As Mr. Annan arrived, Syrian activists said President Bashar al-Assad's forces had killed at least 41 people, including 8 children, in an artillery assault on the city of Hama over the past 24 hours. The report, which could not be independently verified, comes after the UN Security Council condemned the massacre of at least 108 civilians, some of them children, in the Syrian town of Hula on Friday. British Foreign Secretary William Hague has been holding talks on the Syrian crisis with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, whose government is a close ally of the Syrian regime. Mr. Hague said that responsibility for ending the violence lay firmly with President Assad.
It is part of the pattern of behavior of the Assad regime, I believe, to commit atrocities and then to try to blame those atrocities on other people. And so we must always have our eyes open to that, difficult as it will be to determine what has happened in any individual incident.
The former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is appearing before the Leveson Inquiry into media standards in the UK. He's been questioned about his relationship with News Corp chairman Rupert Murdoch. Mr. Blair said the close relationship between politicians and the media was inevitable, but that it became unhealthy when media groups tried to use their newspapers as instruments of political power. Police in the Kenyan capital Nairobi say they believe today's explosion could have been as a result of faulty wiring. A spokesman ruled out a grenade or bomb attack. The explosion has left at least 28 people hurt and a building extensively damaged. The Vatican has denied Italian press reports that a cardinal was among those being investigated in a scandal over leaked documents that has shaken the highest levels of the Roman Catholic Church. The crisis deepened this week when Italian media said at least one cardinal was among those suspected of leaking sensitive documents as part of a power struggle at the top of the church. Vatican spokesman Federico Lombardi told journalists at the Holy See that the Vatican would not allow media pressure to rush an investigation which has led to the arrest of Pope Benedict's butler over leaks of sensitive documents. But Bob Moynihan, editor of the magazine Inside the Vatican, warned of the extent of the crisis.
I think this is a very serious moment. It's a grave crisis because it has to do with a breach of trust in the inner circle of the Vatican. The Pope can't be sure that a document on his own desk isn't going to be taken and photocopied. It seems that the person taking those documents has been discovered, but there's a general feeling that this represents something more than that, that there was someone else behind it.
Correspondents in the Middle East say 19 people, including 13 children, have been killed in a fire at a shopping mall in the Qatari capital Doha. The fire broke out at the Villaggio Mall in the city's west end. State media in China has announced that the country has expelled its former railways minister Liu Xinjiang from the ruling Communist Party for suspected involvement in economic crimes. A spokesperson said Mr. Liu's behaviour has caused serious disciplinary violations. His case has been handed over for investigation to the judicial authorities, according to the official Xinhua news agency. Investors in Spain have said they believe the country's debt to be the riskiest it has been, as fears grow over the health of the country's banking sector. The premium for Spain's 10-year bond over its German equivalent rose to 5.05 percentage points, the highest since the euro was formed. The Spanish Prime Minister admitted on Monday that the situation in Spain was extremely difficult. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James, and we'll be hearing more from you in about 25 minutes' time. You are listening to Midori House. It is just coming up to, it's about 5 minutes past one in the morning in Hong Kong. It's 20.05 in Addis Ababa. It's 18.05 here in London. We're back after this.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afto en to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House. You're in Midori House in Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé, here on Monocle 24. Well, hundreds of the world's business leaders and policymakers will arrive in Thailand this week to attend, well, it's the Asian edition of the World Economic Forum, East Asia 2012. The focus is on connectivity. And a little earlier, I spoke with Gwen Robinson, Bangkok correspondent for the Financial Times, to look ahead to this year's Economic Forum, just before she jumped on a plane back to Bangkok from Tokyo. Gwen, it's interesting with the WEFs because everyone, of course, every year they focus on Davos and this is really the scene setter for the entire year. And then, of course, there are all of these mini WEF conferences all over the world. And a lot of them go completely unnoticed. But do you think there's something of a coup with this one because of the whole timing around Burma that every single investor, every head of state is beating a path to Rangoon at the moment? And of course, you've got a Thailand, which posted 11% increase in the first quarter of this year. So maybe the spotlight's going to be a little bit bigger than normal.
Well, exactly. I mean, for the Thais, I think this is a really big deal because not only, as you said, Tyler, the world's eyes are on Burma, but to get both Aung San Suu Kyi and the president of Burma to come to this this meeting was regarded as a huge coup. So it is a little disappointment that the news came through today that the president will postpone his appearance, whereas, at least Aung San Suu Kyi will come ahead. And that's a big deal in itself. And I think that's also drawing a lot of media attention in itself. But as you say, for Thailand, this is a moment. They've bounced back from these terrible floods last year and the violence the year before. They want to prove that they can pull this one off. It's the first time that the World Economic Forum has ever been held in Thailand. And it's a very big turnout. They're claiming they've got heads of state or leaders of up to 20 countries, I think, as well as 600 delegates, etc., from all over the world. Of course, it's always seen as a kind of second best to the big WEF, which is Davos. But for a regional one, this one is looking pretty good so far.
And Gwen, you cover the entire, well, not the entire region, but you've got a pretty big neighborhood to look after for the Financial Times. Of course, you have Thailand and you've got Burma and you've got Laos and you've got Cambodia. And maybe there's a couple of others that have crept into the mix as well. So do you think this is still Thai focused? Is Thailand the winner out of this? Or do you think this is truly regional and there's a lot of airtime also then for Burma as much as Cambodia and Laos as well?
Well, indeed, that's a good point. I mean, they've taken great pains, the Thais, to emphasize that the theme is shaping the region's future through connectivity, whatever that may mean and however you want to interpret it. It could be technological or all kinds of soft power ways, which seems to have permeated the schedule with a vast array of topics and speakers and panels. But I think it's very much seen as a regional effort because you've got the heads of countries such as Laos and Vietnam and various other regional countries, and also a lot of top Western executives of very big multinationals that are moving increasingly into the region. So I think there'll be a very big emphasis on pitching it as a very regional affair. And, you know, Yingluck, the Prime Minister of Thailand, is taking a very big role in this. And also the way they're promoting Aung San Suu Kyi will be seen as a kind of championing of the regional cause and the maybe the coming out, so to speak, of ASEAN as a bloc, able to host these kind of big gatherings.
You were once based in Bangkok. You've done, you know, obviously, you know, quite a significant stint up in Japan. I guess you're coming up to your, I guess, half year point now with the FT back in their Bangkok bureau. Just what is your read on the street? You know, both of, I guess, Bangkok's role regionally. I mean, you mentioned, you know, obviously a real coming together of ASEAN. I mean, how bullish are you on the patch that you're covering?
Well, God, Tyler, you've made me feel tired, sort of reminding me of all these areas I'm trying to cover.
Well, great. I know how much you're running around constantly. So, I mean, and, you know, as it's amazing when you see, you know, not just Thailand's growth, but, you know, but growth in terms of that whole area. It is, it seems like your editor, you know, gave you a pretty important gig.
Well, you know, a lot of people sitting in Europe, which is obsessed with its own problems at the moment, and America obsessed with, you know, the upcoming elections. I guess Southeast Asia might seem a distant part of the world, but actually when you're sitting here and also in the neighbouring big countries such as Japan and China, you can't help feel new and positive energy emerging from Southeast Asia. And I think people, the rest of the world, has yet to wake up to the fact that 2015, in just 2 or 3 years' time, you've got a very serious effort coming together of what they're calling the ASEAN Economic Community, which is really a very serious effort to tear down trade barriers, enable, you know, mobility of labour, all kinds of things. And you can really feel the change in the air going around Southeast Asian countries, that they're extremely serious about making this work. We'll see in practice. It's still a couple of years down the track, but already you can see, you know, you've got Myanmar next year hosting Southeast Asian Games. They're the chair of ASEAN the following year. You've got, you know, Cambodia chairing it this year, and leaders sort of flocking to these regional meetings. So without sounding too boosterish, I would say that there's really a very definite feeling of energy that wasn't there a few years ago, and you can see it on the streets.
Gwen, we're going to let you run off and catch your flight back down to Bangkok and, of course, cover the events of WEF, but hopefully we'll be catching up with you later in the week. That was Gwen Robinson from the Financial Times. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The June issue of Monocle is a round-the-world ticket that takes in the best boats and planes and trains in our annual transport survey. We also reach for the skies as we climb to the top of Tokyo's new Skytree Tower, stay ahead as we meet an Ethiopian Olympic icon, and visit Kolkata as the city tries to step up a gear. And there's lots more.
In the affairs section, we head to Bogota and Cartagena to see how Colombia is set to become a South American superpower. We meet Tibet's new leader, and we also visit the Emirate you've probably never heard of.
In the business section this month, we start off by firing the starting pistol in the London Olympics with an in-depth look at the suppliers behind the games, from Italian exercise equipment to French flag-making expertise. We'll also be learning how Cathay Pacific's new high-flying CEO manages, and we'll be staying in the region when we head to the Indonesian city of Yogyakarta, which provides a much cosier version of the congested capital.
There's also our 36-page Thailand National Survey that puts a spotlight on the country's top tech firms, horticultural hothouses, and some cool brewers too. The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you are back with Midori House. It's almost a quarter past the hour here in a very, very sunny London. I believe it's still sunny outside or beyond the studio anyway. So on that note, why don't we have Beautiful Day by Maria Takeuchi. That was a properly Genki song. That was Maria Takeuchi with Beautiful Day here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Just before we go to a very short break and we get to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, this is a little something which gives you sort of an indication of who's in favor, who's not in the world. Air Transport World, which is a aviation trade title. Every week they launch their major air routes, well, new routes, but also those that have been cut. So this is just a little highlight of what's just come out. So not great news for, well, traffic between Latin America and the South Pacific or Australasia, because due to budget constraints, the Buenos Aires-Auckland route by Aerolíneas Argentinas is being cut. But you can see the importance of Nigeria. If you look at Iberia, they're launching a fourth weekly flight between Madrid and Lagos. Also, I guess there's definitely room for traffic now between the Rocky Mountain State and also Tokyo, because United Airlines have announced that they're going to launch daily service between Denver and Tokyo Narita with their new 787. That's not until this timetable change at the, well, next spring, March 31st, 2013. The Turks are making moves on the Baltic region. They're going to be launching a three times weekly Istanbul-Tallinn service. And that, of course, is amidst also discussion that the Turks or Turkish Airlines might be setting up a hub also in Warsaw, if indeed they take a stake in LOT Airlines. And finally, perhaps no surprise, just given Chinese influence in Africa, but Korean Air have announced that they're going to launch a three times weekly service, so connecting Seoul Incheon to Nairobi. And of course, Korean already has a massive route network into China, so it would be, of course, connecting Chinese cities through Incheon into Nairobi. It is just 20 minutes past the hour. Here at Midori House in London, we're back with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, in a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no gigantes.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And it's almost 21 minutes past the hour. That would be the hour of 1800 here in London. Joining us in the studio now is our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who's been very busy upstairs today because we are, what, 72 hours away, Steve, from the close of our...
I think it's less than that.
It might even be less than that, of our July-August issue, which, of course, has a quality of life theme running throughout it. But I don't think we're going to be starting on...
And it's a mammoth one as well.
It is. It is going to... It will be bigger than last year's. I've been trying to find... In fact, you know, there's no paper left. We've been trying to squeeze a little bit more paper up, but the particular Toro, the stock that we use for the main body paper, there's none left in all of Europe. They can't make anymore, so...
I've got to say, I wasn't incredibly disappointed to hear that.
Well,
when I realized that would have meant more pages.
Well,
for
yeah, I was looking for more pages for advertising. But anyway,
okay,
nevertheless, I was talking about quality of life, but which I don't think we can make any clever segues when we talk about Syria at the moment. So, just with your sort of global affairs take on the world at the moment, you want to start on Syria today?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be sort of the big story for the week, or at least I hope it's the big story of the week. I think there's a lot of things all over the world that are perhaps not so important that are sort of pushing their way onto the front pages, but Syria is, I mean, it's been bubbling away for several weeks without really making the front pages. It obviously did over the weekend with this massacre of more than 100 people, including dozens of children, in the town of Hula. And Kofi Annan has just arrived in Damascus now. He's going to have talks with senior officials, supposedly with Bashar al-Assad tomorrow. He said he'll have a frank conversation, which is sort of diplomatic ease for we're going to have a row.
Mm.
As much as Kofi Annan can have a row with anyone. And he'll be aiming to try and sort of revive his peace plan, which, you know, he's come under a lot of criticism, you know, from people who want stronger things to happen. But I think, you know, no one else had a better peace plan.
Mm.
And he's at least brought China and Russia into the process. One other thing that happened today is that UN Security Council met and the full council, including Russia and China, signed off on a statement condemning, quote, the outrageous use of force by the Syrian government. So it's interesting that Russia and China, despite the fact they really don't want to see anything happen there, realise that they have to, that they can't sort of stand idly by.
Mm. So we have Mr. Annan in Syria. He's going to have a frank discussion. But as you said, it's unlikely that it's going to be that harsh, knowing that it's Mr. Annan. So I don't want you to act out the conversation, but if you are if you're Mr. Assad and you're hearing this, are you simply able to sort of just cross your arms and nod politely and then get on with another hula next weekend? Is that what happens? Or show of force at the Security Council in terms of, you know, some type of sort of, you know, unanimous, you know, point of view, does he start to play his cards a little bit differently?
I think we're already sort of seeing the beginnings through their sort of proxies in the media of a sort of a line from the Syrian regime. They're saying that, okay, yes, there are some elements in the army that have been a bit harsh, but we're trying to crack down on armed groups, armed opponents that have foreign backing. This is a conspiracy. Saudi Arabia involved, Israel are involved, the US is involved. This is about sovereignty, and try and build up some support with Russia, China, others, like, for example, Iran, in that way. But yes, I mean, he'll probably sort of say, oh, I'm willing to negotiate. I'm willing to sort of talk to some of these people. One other thing that happened over the last day or so in Syria, which is interesting, is, and I think we're going to look at this in a bit more detail on the Daily tonight, is that the way that Yemen evolved with the US and the Gulf Cooperation Council there trying to get some sort of negotiated settlement where the president stepped down for his vice president, is being floated by the Obama administration as a possible route for Syria. The one problem with that is that, you know, anyone who watches Yemen will know it hasn't changed anything. The regime is still in place. So I'd be wary about that.
Do you see anyone else coming to the mix? And you've been in Ankara quite a bit. You've spent time with the foreign minister. What role does Turkey play in all of this? Because, you know, they've been an active participant. Obviously, they're sitting watching. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, what could be going on in a more clandestine way. How do you think they play it as we move towards summer as well?
Well, when this all started, Turkey was trying to be an honest broker. They saw Damascus as maybe not a friend, but they were realistic about it. Mm. You know, they share a very long border with and quite porous border at times with Syria. They've travelled back and forth to Damascus numerous occasions. And, you know, their officials would say, well, look, we keep on telling them they need to reform. And they say, yes, 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 we will. And then they never do. And they made a very clear break last year and said, right, we've had it. Yeah, this can't go on. And they've come down very clearly on the side of the opposition. And so they're doing what they can to host the opposition groups. They are channeling funds or sort of being the conduit for funds for the Syrian National Council. I think they are incredibly wary, as you would be if you've got this country on your doorstep, which you don't know what's going to happen if it starts crumbling. So it's very tricky for them, but they are quite clearly now, you know, on the side of some sort of intervention, be it military or otherwise.
Just before we go, let's look at the Iberian Peninsula specifically. We don't need to talk about Portugal, but we do need to talk about Spain.
Yeah.
Bankia, you just only had to sort of, you know, spend any time watching Bloomberg today, and of course, just, you know, a major story in terms of, you know, the bailout that is occurring, but also just what this means for, you know, just general confidence, you know, in Spain at the moment.
Yes, I mean, it's in real trouble. There's been very little news from Greece today, because the media have been on strike there. So instead, all the attention has been on Spain. And in fact, quite rightly, their bond yields are approaching record highs. They had this massive slump in shares in one of the biggest banks, Bankia. I think it was about 27%. And the worry is that the Spanish government said, oh, don't worry, we're gonna bail this bank out. We're going to sort it out. No one's quite sure where Spain's going to get the money for this.
Right. And particularly also, what's amazing, you know, a bank which is not a household name internationally, you know, in the way that BBVA or the way that you know, Santander would be, and yet we're talking about, you know, something to the tune of, like, you know, 9 billion euros.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge, and when you, and this is also, I mean, Spain's a classic example of which we've seen in some other countries, particularly Ireland, where actually the problem isn't that, you know, public sector spending was completely out of control. It was private sector spending, it was the banks. Mm. And now the government has tried to step in to support the banks, and now the government's got no money. And that's when you see the public sector cuts, the austerity, massive unemployment, you know, the 50% youth unemployment you've got in Spain, and a lot of anger about it. So it's a very difficult situation that no one is quite really dealing with very well at the moment. And Spain has got itself in a hole, and will be interesting to see over the next few days if it can get it out.
And just as I was mentioning earlier, when I was just doing those little whiz round of air routes, you know, it's you know, on one side you sort of look at Madrid, you know, making overtures. Obviously, there's traffic going into Nigeria, probably on the part of the Spanish oil companies, etc. But you wonder also what's going to happen with just tourism traffic this summer, because, you know, there's not even really sort of money for really any outward promotion, really. So, you know, does Spain come top of mind? Does Greece come top of mind? And you know, you're talking about probably, you know, well, for both countries, you know, foreign receipts. This is their peak season.
Well, Spain doesn't have as big a problem at the moment as Greece does. I mean, because the problem is for Greece is that everyone's seen the riots, everyone's seen the problems they're having. And already there were some figures out earlier today saying they're down a third on receipts for May compared to last year. And last year they're already in crisis. So, you know, they're in a very strong, very bad situation. Spain, I think, is probably going to be all right this summer unless you see actual civil unrest.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor. See you back upstairs on the editorial floor. Lots of pages to ghost.
I know. I'll get back to it.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yokso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met the Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
And in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be asking why the makers of the AK-47 Kalashnikov rifle are planning an assault on the world of high-end fashion, and we'll be hearing the latest from the Leveson Inquiry. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan has arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus as violence continues 6 weeks after he struck a ceasefire deal. As Mr. Annan arrived, Syrian activists said President Bashar al-Assad's forces had killed at least 41 people, including 8 children, in an artillery assault on the city of Hama over the past 24 hours. The former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been appearing before the Leveson Inquiry into media standards in the UK. He's been questioned about his relationship with News Corp chairman Rupert Murdoch. Police in the Kenyan capital Nairobi say they believe today's explosion could have been as a result of faulty wiring. A spokesman ruled out a grenade or bomb attack. The explosion has left at least 28 people hurt and a building extensively damaged. The Vatican has denied Italian press reports that a cardinal was among those being investigated in a scandal over leaked documents that has shaken the highest levels of the Roman Catholic Church. The crisis deepened this week when Italian media said at least one cardinal was among those suspected of leaking sensitive documents as part of a power struggle at the top of the church. Correspondents in the Middle East say 19 people, including 13 children, have been killed in a fire at a shopping mall in the Qatari capital, Doha. The fire broke out at the Villaggio Mall in the city's west end. And state media in China have announced that the country has expelled its former railways minister, Liu Zhijong, from the ruling Communist Party for suspected involvement in economic crimes. A spokesperson said Mr. Liu's behaviour had caused serious disciplinary violations. And those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. Well, as you just heard in that bulletin, we were talking about the Leveson inquiry into media ethics, and of course it's had its fair share of dramatic days over the past 3 months as a procession of senior government ministers, media moguls, and tabloid editors have taken the stand and undergone the mild-mannered yet probing grilling from lead counsel Robert Jay. Well, today's witness, though, was perhaps the most high-profile to date and certainly the most polished performer. Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair spent several hours answering questions about his relationship with Rupert Murdoch and his views on Britain's media. So what did we learn? Well, I'm joined on the line now from Westminster by one of Mr. Blair's biographers, John Rentle. Hello, John.
Hello there. Well, I guess
for those listeners, particularly in Asia, who may not have been tuning in because it was prime time, how did Mr. Blair fare today?
Well, as you might expect, he gave a very polished performance. None of his views on the relations between politicians and the press would come as a surprise to anybody who's followed him. I mean, he said that, you know, he obviously tried to get a fair hearing for the Labour Party from all powerful media organisations in Britain that mostly included, the most important was Rupert Murdoch's company. And that's, you know, the allegation that is commonly heard against him is that he got too close to Rupert Murdoch and their relationship was too cozy.
Mm. How essential was it for the proceedings that that Mr. Blair made an appearance? And again, I guess people who aren't close to UK politics, is this also, I mean, yes, the relationship is well known, but also a balancing act as well between, of course, the current government and also Labour.
Yeah. How essential was it that they should hear from Tony Blair? Is a very good question because it goes to the heart of why we're having this inquiry, and the real reason we're having this inquiry is because David Cameron, the Prime Minister, was too weak to resist it because of his personal relations with Rupert Murdoch, which are, you know, quite close, or have been quite close. You know, he employed someone who used to work for Rupert Murdoch as his press secretary. And so, you know, David Cameron was embarrassed when News of the World, when Rupert Murdoch's journalists were found to have engaged in widespread phone hacking. So he set up this inquiry. Why they had to hear from Tony Blair, I don't know. You know, one of the most famous things that Tony Blair said just before he stepped down as Prime Minister was he gave a speech in which he attacked British journalism as a feral beast and said that it wasn't accountable for its mistakes in the way that politicians are. So I suppose that was part of the thinking.
How much of this is window dressing? And you know, we've been talking a lot about, you know, this summer of bread and circuses that we're going to have. You know, of course we have Diamond Jubilee upon us. Then we've got the Olympics. Is there almost a sense of let's almost get this sort out of the way, then, you know, okay, the Jubilee will carry on. But there's almost, you know, this sense of, yeah, tidy up the windows and then we can move on and hopefully we'll be in a much better place, you know, come last quarter of the year for this country.
Well, I mean, that would be David Cameron's calculation.
Yes.
He didn't want to have this inquiry because of the effect it's had in disclosing all sorts of private emails and texts and embarrassing conversations that he and his ministers have had with senior people in Rupert Murdoch's company. But you know, that said, I suppose yes, they want to get it out of the way. But the problem with these kinds of inquiries, and the reason he didn't want to set it up, is that they do tend to sort of develop a momentum of their own, and you know, there's no knowing how long this one's going to drag out and what the consequences will be.
In the background, you know, how much is Fleet Street cooperating? And by cooperation, I mean that there must be, you know, plenty that various political desks are sitting on. And I'll go back to, once the circus is pulled out of town, you know, could this also take a very ugly turn as well? I'm just wondering how much of there's almost a gentleman's agreement in the background that that the press needs to play nicely, at least for now.
I think that's a little bit too conspiratorial for me, that the idea that the journalists are capable of sitting on good quality material for any length of time is not borne out by events. But no, I think certainly some parts of the cheap press are on their best behaviour at the moment and are trying to avoid using their traditional illegal methods of getting stories. And you know, undoubtedly there'll be some slip back. You know, all of this, in my view, is not actually going to make much difference in the end. I mean, there'll be some new form of regulation, independent regulation of the press. But you know, does that include Twitter and blogs and the internet or what? It all just starts to get too complicated, and most people will just put it in the too complicated department, and nothing very much will happen.
So maybe just quite a considerable, maybe not waste of money, but a rather large deployment of funds that might have been used more appropriately elsewhere.
Well, it provides very good footage for daytime news channels. So, you know, it hasn't gone to waste. And, you know, a lot of the stuff is very interesting. But the one thing about the British press is that it is incredibly vicious and varied and aggressive and competitive. And one of the things it's competitive about is what should be done to regulate it. And, you know, there are as many different views on that as there are newspapers.
Great. John Rentall, Chief Political Commentator at The Independent on Sunday, and also Tony Blair biographer. Thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. It is just 18:38 here in London. We're back after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
And you are back at Midori House and in Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé. It's just 18:40 here in London. Well, if you're looking to update your summer wardrobe, the makers of the AK-47 assault rifle may soon have something to die for. The company, which produces one of the world's most popular automatic weapons, is in talks with the family of the gun's namesake, Mikhail Kalashnikov, to obtain the rights to the Kalashnikov brand. The company hopes that the AK-47's reliable reputation will help it sell high-end products under the same name and even high-end clothing. Well, joining us now in the studio to discuss more is our, well, not just luxury goods analyst, but also retail industry analyst, Sagarmartha DeRozan. Welcome.
Hello.
This isn't unprecedented, because a lot of people who are familiar with weaponry will know that Beretta, for example, is a very good example of a company known not just for hunting rifles, but also they do make some top-selling assault weapons as well. And they have a very popular range of hunting clothing. You can look on many major streets around the world, and there are Beretta stores. So do you think that's what the Kalashnikovs have in mind?
I think they're using it certainly as an example or as a model to follow, and that's probably where it comes, the whole inspiration and to do this. And, you know, and you mentioned Beretta, but also Holland or Porthy, traditional, you know, gun makers to the Queen, I guess. They also have successful clothing ranges. So, I mean, the brand extension into fashion you know, it's not too complicated to do for some of these brands. I think that, the situation with Kalashnikov is a little bit different, because whilst I do agree that they have like some really good brand associations, or like real, you know, they're very reliable, they're very precise. In my mind, they're kind of associated with the baddies, not with the goodies.
Right.
If you know what I mean, more with the kind of rebels or terror. So I think that you have to kind of get over that somehow. But, you know, is it possible to build a clothing brand with that name? I say yes. I mean, I'm thinking paratrooper chic, you know, with a camouflage and special forces or something like that, kind of to move it beyond the kind of rebel of Afghanistan or something.
I mean, as you're saying, it's very easy to take a brand like Holland and Beretta and Purdy's, and you know, these, they have, you know, well, some of them have their roots, you know, certainly with stores in Mayfair, and it's about the gentle hunting life. Whereas when we think about AK-47s and Kalashnikov, you know, we think about revolutions and we think about terrorists and in general the baddies. So let's say it goes ahead, it could be successful. But do you think it's also something which is also maybe a very short burn, that this is something someone would invest into the family, and it's something for 4 or 5 seasons?
You never know with these things. Because if they're well done, and if they're well executed, and then if the product ticks the boxes, it can survive much longer than that, I think. I think what they're trying to do here, for what I've read and that, is that is to actually gain control of the brand, and I think they're using this as a mechanism to entice the family of Mikhail, which still has the rights of the name, in order to better control the brand. Because so what I've heard is that there's like tons of souvenirs around with Kalashnikov, and that is actually probably hurting the brand overall, because they're kind of cheapy and not interesting, and this may be the avenue to launch something like this to actually gain a better control of the whole brand than they have today.
But is it possible? The last time I saw a T-shirt for sale with a Kalashnikov on it was in Baalbek. Was for sale by Hezbollah. It was a yellow shirt with, you know, a green Kalashnikov on the front of it. I mean, it's going to be very hard, though, for the Kalashnikov legal team to probably go after Hezbollah, who are also probably a big client of theirs as
yes.
well.
Yes, I would say. I'm of two minds, because as you said, like all these other gun makers that have had, relative success or big success in expanding into clothing, have done that from approaching it as a sport. You know, it's a sport, it's a pastime, even if there are some of them do supply, you know, the army of countries and all that. But I think, you know, Kalashnikov has a very... based on this kind of rebel and revolutionary, and you know, there is something to that as well. So yeah. I think they could do something. I mean, there's no Russian brands that are particularly globally well known, are they? I mean,
no,
I mean, other than the vodka ones. And these guys already have a vodka, supposedly.
As well. No, as you said, that there is maybe a certain, you know, rebel type of romance which exists, and that's why I sort of feel it's something that it would come out, it would get a lot of attention, you would have sort of people lining up, but you know, it have sort of the shelf life of even an Abercrombie and Fitch store opening up, and then it kind of is big, and then it sort of it has to move into another market or something.
I think you're completely right. In that sense, it needs to be amazingingly executed in order to have
executed
longevity.
Being sort of the operative word.
Yeah,
I wonder, is this something which almost not being, you know, overly cynical about it, but you know, where you could have had a McKinsey analyst go in and someone from the family calls them up and they say, well, you know, how can we get control of our brand? And someone says, well, you know, have you ever thought of a fashion collection? You know, how do you take Kalashnikov lifestyle? Imagine, you know, the spin-off range you could have with the AK-47. Is that what happens in most companies today, Sagra, that you know, the analysts come in, and if there's any hope of brand extension, then someone says you need to move into retail?
I'm not sure this one comes out of McKinsey myself.
No, maybe not. The
Russian version. You know, and there were in some of the articles that I read, it was like some quote to this thing that like this brand is worth $10 billion and it could be worth $10 billion already, and it could be worth, you know, $150 billion a la Apple. You know, I'm not quite sure that launching clothing is going to get Kalashnikov there. But I think that today, you know, and we've talked about this in the past, you know, this whole trend of brand extensions and brand collaborations, I mean, it's a really important trend in luxury, in brands, in fashion, everywhere. And I think that it's here to stay and it's trending towards more extreme categories. It's just not if you make watches, then you make jewelry. We're going to see things that are going to surprise us. And I don't have a problem with that because I think that's part of a brand evolution. Yet they need to make sense and they need to feel right once you see them. You know, some of the more kind of immediate brand extensions do not work at all because they're not interesting products that the customer wants. And some of the more faraway ones work very well because somehow something clicks in the mind of the customer. So I think in this market, there is not as much, there's not a rule that kind of can unify the whole thing.
Mm. Just before we go, if you were managing my fund, I'm wondering, would you be investing in it? I mean, if there was an opportunity, would you...
No.
No, you wouldn't.
I don't think so. No. I'm not saying that it's not going to be successful, but it's not my...
Yeah, you wouldn't be putting our money there.
I don't think so. I think there are better places.
Great. Second one, Theodore, I'm going to let you go out and enjoy the fantastic weather that we're having in London before the sun goes down. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment. And you are back at Midori House with me, Tyler Berlade. It's just 18:48 here in London. Time for song. Here's Robin with Hang With Me. And that was Robin with Hang With Me here on Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment. Now here's a little something for Memorial Day on Midori House. The American flag was barely 50 years old when the Annan family decided to branch into flag making. Alexander Annan began making U.S. flags for the merchant ships in his sailmaking shop on the New York City waterfront in the 1820s. Annan Flags is the brand for all patriotic proceedings. Apollo 11 took an Annan flag to the moon, and it was an Annan flag that wrapped Abraham Lincoln's coffin. With one in every 15 Americans having a visible flag on their houses, flags are a massive business in the United States. And on the line to tell us more is an Annan veteran of 35 years, Bob Caggiano. Hello, Mr. Caggiano.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I wonder when we've Memorial Day, of course, you've got July 4th not far away as well. Is this really the big season for your business on your side of the Atlantic?
Well, our season actually starts around the beginning of May and goes through end of July, but certainly the two events that are celebrated the most are Memorial Day and 4th of July. Obviously two different events in its entirety. The Memorial Day is to honor the war veterans, and 4th of July is to honor our independence.
Now, I want to focus, because it is Memorial Day, on the U.S. flag business. I'll talk about maybe the international side of the business, you know, if there is one, in a moment. But how stable a business, you know, is it today when, of course, you know, flags can express themselves, of course, on, you know, jumbo displays over Times Square, and they can be fluttering, you know, animated over stadiums now. But is the good old fabric flag still a decent business to be in?
You know, it is. It's not an industry that grows with leaps and bounds, of course, unless you have some catastrophic event like 9/11. But it's a pretty steady business. It really, you know, a recession doesn't necessarily have much of an effect on it. You know, you have this growth of 2 or 3% every year, and unless the economy is really, really bad, there's very few setbacks.
Well, and as you mentioned, the U.S. economy has not been at its best of late. It's been looking a little bit, you know, rosier. So when you talk about sort of, you know, 2 to 3% growth, you know, does that mean it's very difficult to obviously start, you know, trimming in very obvious places, because then there'd be no flag left. So, you know, having been through quite a rough patch, you know, lately, was it a little bit flatter than usual? Was the flagpole a little more limp?
Well, you know, in 2009, I guess the recession kind of hit here in the States, and we just had a slight decrease in business, but only a couple of percentage points. And though, but 2010, 2011, it rebounded, and, you know, maybe 5 or 6%. Right now, we're probably around 2 or 3% over 2011, and we expect that to continue through the year. The Americans are a flag-waving group. They appreciate the flag and what it stands for, so it never really goes out of style.
When you mention style, which brings me to fashion, and there's been a lot of discussion in the United States about, you know, where things are made. A lot of brands, of course, you know, wanting to fly the flag when things are made in the United States. I have to ask this question: are all your flags made in the U.S.?
100% of our U.S. flags are made here in the U.S. down to the fabric itself. Most Americans do not want a flag made offshore. They'll, you know, if they buy it in the store and then see that it's made in China or something, they will return it. In most cases, we almost have that built-in insulation that, you know, I guess if the flag flying public would accept a flag made offshore in China or Vietnam or something, our business may change. But you know, most people want that flag made in the USA.
It sounds like probably some of you, well, maybe you don't have true competitors, but it sounds like some people have obviously made that misstep, and there's been a lot of flags brought back to the returns counter.
Well, I guess if they have been made in China, they have been returned. We do have competition. We have a couple of other manufacturers here in the U.S., but we're a lot larger than all of them. You know, our product is pretty much the highest quality in the industry, and we kind of do it on our quality, service, reliability, integrity. We've been around, like you said, since 1820.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that, Bob Caggiano from Annan Flags. I'm wishing you a very happy Memorial Day over on your side of the Atlantic. We're almost at the end of the program. Just a very quick moment just to look at the front pages. The New Zealand Herald is talking about a murder story, tattooed loner at the center of a murder inquiry, and also staying in New Zealand as well. It says the design for Christchurch should center around three precincts, and that's according to an Australian planner who's referencing a lot of the success in Melbourne. And the Sydney Morning Herald, just before we go as well, safety warning from the Rail Corp as it cuts night security staff. So bring your pepper spray when you get on the train next time in Sydney. That's all the time we have for today. Today's show is produced by Don Trump. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. In 3 hours' time at 2200, Emma Nelson and Chloe Potter here with The Monocle Daily. And up next is Rob Bound with Culture. But for me, for all of us here at Midori House, it's goodbye.